series of moves that the government made that they thought would tamp down the protests actually served to rev them up.
Tiananmen Square remembered. It's Friday, June 4th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, amid Tiananmen vigil crackdowns, voices remain strong. A Chinese-American probes Mars. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The United States has condemned actions by Hong Kong authorities to stifle dissent, calling out attempts to erase memories of the Tiananmen Square massacre ahead of today's anniversary. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration called the Chinese government's violent suppression of peaceful demonstrations in and around Tiananmen Square on June 4, 1989, a massacre. In Hong Kong, the June 4th museum said it would temporarily close because of a licensing probe by authorities. Hong Kong police have cited COVID-19 restrictions in prohibiting an annual vigil to commemorate the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown for the second consecutive year. Hong Kong's Security Bureau also warned residents not to participate in this year's June 4th vigil, citing penalties of up to 5 years in prison for those attending and a year in jail for anyone advertising or publicizing it. Jeffrey Wasserstrom is professor of history at the University of California, Irvine. Wasserstrom's research interests began with the role of student protests and have grown to include the social history of China and comparative social history. He explains the buildup to the June 4th crackdown.
I think one thing that's significant looking back is that the fact that there was a crackdown wasn't really what seemed so surprising at the time. What seemed surprising was how long it took for the government to take decisive actions. And I think that division at the top is a key part of things. One is that in a lot of ways the protests were simply calling on the Communist Party to live up to its own professed ideals. And there could be some resonance of that among Communist Party officials at the time. There was probably a hope on the part of the leadership that this would just fizzle out, that this would dissipate. And then there was also a hope, I think, when they brought out this harsh editorial April 26th condemning the protesters and saying that the protesters were creating turmoil, a kind of code word for the kind of chaos that was associated with the Cultural Revolution period that nobody really wanted to go back to, that the protesters would just leave. But in fact, that editorial just angered a lot of people who saw what was going on in the streets not as turmoil and chaos, but as simple demands for change that were acceptable. And so a series of moves that the government made that they thought would tamp down the protests actually served to rev them up. So there were a variety of factors going on there.
The government in Beijing moved very quickly to distance itself from the events of June 4th. In fact, pretty much tried to erase that from the public memory. And one of the amazing outcomes of the events then is that they were highly successful in doing so. Why is the government still so fearful of what happened that day?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I mean, I do think the whole phenomenon of this effort to put a state of amnesia on the events. I mean, I do think that what the Communist Party keeps saying is, look how far we've come, look how far we've come. Look at how strong China is in the world. Look at the booming economy. Look at the spectacle of the Olympics. And I think it goes along with the forced amnesia, because it's an effort to keep people distracted and focusing on different things, so that even if they get an inkling of the messiness that the government was involved with, that maybe this will discourage them from pushing too hard, trying too hard to find out more. And anything that the Western press has gotten wrong then or since is exploited to say, well, they got that wrong, so maybe they're lying about everything. So even though there's enormous proof of a vicious crackdown, these different factors working together have been disturbingly successful within the mainland because there is so much control over the media communication.
Jeffrey Wasserstrom, professor of history at the University of California, Irvine. Coming up on VOA Asia, we hear from a student leader inside the 1989 pro-democracy movement. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Storm kills three, displaces thousands in Philippines. Bomb rips through minivan in Afghan capital, killing at least four. Slow start, China mobilizes to vaccine at headlong pace. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and so much more when you visit us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Check us out on Instagram and Twitter and at our website, voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. To provide some perspective about what happened at Tiananmen Square in 1989, I spoke with one of the top four student leaders of that movement, Shen Tong.
I was a student back in 1989, a third-year student at Beijing University. When I was involved in the student movement since 1986, but when the spring of 1989 started, I was first elected as the student autonomous union in Beida, Peking University, and then later on become the early organizer of what's known as a dialogue delegation, one of the three main umbrella student organizations. Our main responsibility was to negotiate with the government on behalf of the demonstrators.
How did the movement gather such growth so that it came to Tiananmen Square?
It was more a moment than a movement, where it really tapped into a national psyche. It's known as a movement or a moment of rising expectations. Things were generally getting better in some significant ways to people's daily life in China, but the perceived and the sudden inequality and very visible official corruptions made people edgy, if not very dissatisfied. So the student protests quickly turned into a broader call of government accountability and of official corruption that really tapped into that national psyche at the time.
Did you get a sense that there was something coming?
It's one of those things that the day before you think it's impossible, the day after you become inevitable. So in some larger sense, I would say nobody predicted that. But then as the event took off, as a moment actually was upon us, all these factors before that seems leading to that inevitability.
Did China miss an opportunity because of this?
Absolutely. I think it's not just China, because it's both symbolic and a real influence in the world affairs. It actually, the world missed a major opportunity. The world history would have been different if the events of the spring of 1989 turned out differently. And there's every possibility that it could have had a different result, that the massacre wasn't inevitable. China could have gone onto a more balanced development instead of embracing this unbalanced full embrace of materialism, which now eventually led to the breakdown of moral, if not social, fabrics in China.
Shen Tong, a top student leader in the pro-democracy movement in Tiananmen Square 32 years ago today. Also in 1989, Shen Tong was named one of the People of the Year by Newsweek magazine. He is now a media and software entrepreneur.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
Happening now in Asia, authorities in Sri Lanka try to head off a potential environmental disaster as a fire-damaged container ship that had been carrying 22 tons of nitric acid and other chemicals partially sank off the country's main port. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, driverless taxis are the topic on this week's VOA Asia Business Scene. Here's Josh Nist.
Chinese tech giant Baidu rolled out its paid driverless taxi service earlier this month. making it the first company that commercialized autonomous driving operations in China. This is the first time that no one is behind the wheel, but a safety member is sitting in the front passenger seat in case of an emergency. Around 10 robo-taxis that pick up and drop off passengers at 8 stops within an area around 3 square kilometers in western Beijing's Shaogun Park. Kelly Wong, a robo-taxi passenger, says she felt safe while using the service.
It was running slowly at the speed of about 30 kilometers per hour in the park. I didn't feel any danger through the process because a safety driver was sitting in the front. I noticed he kept observing the traffic situation. Yeah, I suggest people come to experience it. It has a strong technological sense because nobody is in the driver's seat.
Passengers can call a robo-taxi on the Apollo Go app, with each ride costing 30 yuan or $4.60 USD. The service has carried more than 210,000 passengers in 3 cities across China and aims to expand to 30 cities in the next 3 years. For Business Scene, I'm Josh Nist.
Now that you've heard this week's Business Scene, see it. Visit VOA Asia on YouTube. As we continue with VOA Asia, the latest U.S. mission to explore Mars has expanded the capabilities of robotics to roll and now fly over the surface in the search for possible life that may have previously existed on the Red Planet. Chinese-American Amy Kwan was a chamber test engineer for the Ingenuity helicopter and works with the U.S. Space Agency's Jet Propulsion Lab. In part two of her conversation with VOA's Adriana Zhang, Kwan talks about the U.S. space program's strengths, a recent Chinese rocket's uncontrolled reentry to Earth, and even some of her favorite foods.
The U.S. advantage in this area is that I believe we're a little bit more open to all those diverse ideas that everybody brings to the table. And we go through those and decide, you know, what has merit. I mean, way back when Curiosity was the Curiosity rover, they decided they were going to land it with what's called a sky crane, right? All the prior rovers had landed with these airbag things. So you can imagine, like, I guess, airbag balloons attached to this thing, and it just kind of bounces. But we had grown the rover size so big that you couldn't really use that method of landing anymore. And they decided they were going to have a crane that has rockets to kind of hover and lower this thing on a cable. And everybody said, oh, you're crazy. They finally convinced them with enough math and background and stuff on that, that that was the way to go. And Curiosity succeeded fantastically. So then we reused that again with the Perseverance rover. So it's openness to things like that. I think that is our advantage.
Some people are saying that China has been irresponsible in space. What do you think about this?
As far as the uncontrolled reentry goes, I think it's ideal that you don't have conditions like that, though sometimes things beyond your control, if things don't work as planned, you can end up with something like that. As far as worrying about that, there is, you're talking about the entire globe. Compared to the size of the globe, this is a relatively small piece. So it's not something that I would be losing sleep over. But in future, I think it would be ideal if it were not an uncontrolled entry.
Back to your bio, you actually mentioned that your favorite Asian food, lo mein.
The story associated with that is I was a kind of picky eater as a child. And my parents ended up taking me to a Chinese restaurant. And that is where I discovered that I really, really like chow mein and put away a couple platefuls as a toddler.
Amy Kwan of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and team member on the latest Mars mission, speaking with VOA's Adriana Zhang. You may hear part one of their discussion on Thursday's edition of VOA Asia, found on our website, voanews.com. That's our program for today and for the week. Thanks for joining us on VOA Asia. Continue online at Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We thank our team, Service Chief Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead. Be safe. Be well.